I'm going to be reading Matthew 15, 21 through 39. If you have a Bible from the seat in front of you, it's on page 976. And if you don't have a Bible of your own, feel free to take that one home. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she is crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." And she said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat there. And great crowds came to him, bringing them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way." And the disciples said to him, "Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd?" And Jesus said to them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, 7 and a few small fish." And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the 7 loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. They all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan.
Father, your word is great, and with it you breathe life. So, Father, breathe life. And also with it, you divide us. You cut us in our soul and expose the things that are there that shouldn't be. And so today, as we look at this passage, do that, Father. Rid from us the things that would disgrace you, that are counter to your character. May we be transformed into the image of Christ by your word. I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. If you were here last week, you know that we saw Jesus upend the traditions of the elders. Right? These traditions that were teachings and cultural practices, not a part of God's law. They were in addition to God's law and way above and beyond the law of God. They were a burden for the people. Impossible to keep all of these things. And in fact, only the most religious, the holiest of the Pharisees, could even assume that they were keeping the majority of them. And yet these traditions had embedded themselves in the Jewish identity so that to be Jewish was to follow these traditions. And so Jesus was upending the traditions of the elders, and in so doing, he was actually transforming the way that the Jews looked at the law of God. He was transforming what relationship with God looked like. We saw this last week. The law of God prohibits Jews from eating certain foods. And then Jesus declares, it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. So thus, there is nothing unclean about what you eat and what you drink. And to the Jews, this was an absolutely revolutionary idea. It transformed, well, it should have transformed the way that they thought about relationship with God, but instead, for many, it just offended them. And they wanted to kill Jesus. But this revolutionary idea, not only did it break down the traditions on what it meant about what you can eat and drink, what it meant about honoring your father and mother, but it also began to break down the cultural barriers, the traditional barriers that separated Jews from Gentiles. It began to dissolve those things so that there is no barrier between Jew and Gentile. And if you don't know, Gentile is just the biblical way of saying not a Jew. So these barriers began to dissolve in the passage we looked at this week. And what Jesus is starting to do is to fling wide the doors of heaven for any who would come to him. It's not about what you eat, what you don't eat. It's not about your bloodline, Jew or Gentile. It's about me. Come to me. The me being Jesus, of course. So the chosen people of God, that idea is expanding. It's expanding to not just be the bloodline of Abraham, but to be a people from every tribe and tongue and nation gathered around the throne, worshiping the Lord of Lords and King of Kings for everlasting time. And that's what Jesus had come to do. That's, in fact, what the word had foretold, that he, the Messiah, this promised son of David, would come for the nations. And remember, David is the son of Jesse. So from a selection from Isaiah 11. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. This is talking about Jesus. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. The wolf shall lie down with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal for the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place shall be glorious, and he will raise a signal for the nations. It's not what I was going to say, but where is that glorious resting place of the Messiah? Right here. Right here. Of him will the nations inquire. And he is a signal for the nations. So that's what we're going to see in this passage today, that Jesus is a signal for the nations. He's bringing together Jew and Gentile in a way that had never been conceived before Christ, at least not in fullness. And then we will see a Canaanite woman who is a brilliant example of faith for us. Let's dive in. Verse 21. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. He went away from there being Galilee, because that's where he just was. In the ESV, English Standard Version, which is what we read from here at Emmanuel, we see in verse 21 two phrases that indicate a departure. There's he went away and he withdrew. Went away means he's geographically leaving Galilee, going on to a different place, and withdrew indicates that Jesus is now leaving Jewish lands. He's going into Gentile territory now. And you'll see, since it says he's going to Tyre and Sidon, they're up there on the left, Tyre and Sidon. It's in yellow, labeled as Tyre. Some call it Phoenicia, but it was part of the Roman province, Syria. And so though it is a part of that Roman province, Tyre and Sidon are cities much older than Rome. They go way back into the Old Testament, and they are perennial, persistent enemies to Israel. And in fact, in the Jewish mind, Tyre and Sidon were like these exemplars of godless arrogance. In fact, there's a lot of people who say one of the clearest pictures we have of the nature of Satan is an illustration of the city of Tyre. Tyre and Sidon, enemies of Israel, symbols of godless arrogance. Well, you actually might remember Tyre and Sidon from back in chapter 11 of Matthew. Do you remember when Jesus referenced these two cities? And in response to Jewish unrepentance in the cities of Galilee, this is what he said. Jesus said in Matthew 11, "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you." Yeah, strong words of condemnation. So though the Messiah, he had come to the Jews of Galilee. Galilee is the first to receive the Messiah. Or not receive him, but to observe him. And yet they wouldn't repent. And we've seen it again and again. Numbers of them, they actually reject Jesus, sometimes violently rejecting Jesus. In Nazareth, his hometown, they tried to kill him. So it was not safe for Jesus to be in Galilee anymore. The Jews were becoming increasingly, some of the Jews anyway, were becoming increasingly hostile towards him. Herod, who ruled Galilee, was becoming increasingly hostile towards him, so he leaves. It's no longer safe in Galilee. And it's not that Jesus is afraid of the danger. It's just not yet time for that danger to take hold of him. So when Jesus goes to Tyre and Sidon, it's primarily to withdraw from the Jews and from Galilee. It doesn't begin as a mission to the Gentiles. And yet, he's Jesus. And so the mighty works of the Messiah travel with him. His compassionate heart goes with him. The Messiah goes to Tyre and Sidon, to the Gentiles. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." So Jesus is apparently walking, right? He's journeying to wherever he's going in the district of Tyre and Sidon, and this woman just comes out of the countryside and begins following him and begins screaming after him, crying out, shouting for the sake of her daughter who's in this desperate situation. Now, Mark, who writes his gospel primarily to Gentiles, to non-Jews, he says that this woman is a Syrophoenician, which would be like sort of a technical Roman term for her ancestry. But Matthew, who writes this gospel primarily to Jews, calls her a Canaanite. Can you guess why? Because the Canaanites are perennial enemies of Israel. And it's true, Syrophoenicians are Canaanites. Canaanites is the much more ancient term. Matthew is not going to let his Jewish readers miss the point that this woman is racially connected to the enemies of God, to the enemies of Israel. She is an enemy of God. She's connected to the enemies of God and the enemies of Israel. So there's a racial connection that Matthew wants his Jewish readers to see. So we've got Tyre and Sidon. We've got a Canaanite. And every Jewish reader would have known what this means. She was unclean in unclean land, and her daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit. Unclean. Didn't Jesus just address the issues of what makes a person clean and unclean? It's like there's a theme that's continuing. And then startling, in a very startling way, this woman, unclean, should be an enemy of God, cries out, "Lord, Son of David." That's an amazing thing for this woman to say. So Lord, it can just be a title of respect for a superior in that time. But surely Matthew wants us to see more in it. And Son of David. That only means one thing. Messiah, the Christ, the Jewish Messiah, specifically, the Jewish Messiah. This woman is saying, you are the Jewish Messiah. You are the Son of David. And that means two things for her. One, she's heard about Jesus already. She knows who he is before he even gets there, which accords to what we already know from the Gospel of Matthew. Back in chapter 4, we read this. So Jesus' fame spread throughout Syria, and they brought him all the sick and those oppressed by demons, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea and beyond the Jordan. This woman has heard how Jesus has cast out demons and comes rushing up on him in the street. Second thing that this means, her calling him the Son of David, it means that somehow and counterintuitively, she had this profound understanding of the Jewish scriptures. And it might not seem like it right here on the surface, because a lot of people were calling him Son of David, but the way she interacts with Jesus proves it. We'll see that as we go. But she is able to see what so few Jews could see. That Jesus is the Messiah, that he is the Son of David, that his works and his teachings, they have evidenced it. This Canaanite woman, she understood more than what most Jews understood. And she has come to him with the condition of her pitiable daughter because she knows he is the only one who could do anything about it. Now, there is a whole lot I don't understand about this woman. I don't know her name. I don't know a lot. But I do know one thing. I do know this love for a daughter. I have four daughters. I love them. If they were suffering, and I would do anything to ease that suffering, to take it from them. If I could take their suffering and put it into my body, I would do it. I'd do it in a heartbeat. I would even throw myself at the feet of somebody and grovel if I thought there was a way that they could bring some healing to my daughter. I think if you're a halfway decent parent, you would do the same. And so this Canaanite woman, she's relentless. She's desperate. She wants her little girl to be healed. And I don't know much about this woman, but I can relate to that, to what that must be like. And Jesus ignores her. I mean, let that hit you. He ignores her. But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she's crying out after us." We haven't seen anything like this in Matthew. A woman comes to Jesus and she's desperate and she's earnest. She's not presumptuous. And Jesus ignores her. He treats her with indifference. And we've read so many times how back in Galilee, Jesus would heal anyone who comes to him. And crowds of people are coming to him, and he's staying up all night long healing and healing and healing. And he has compassion. He's moved with compassion. He heals. But that was back in Jewish lands. Now we're in Gentile territory. This is unclean land. And so Jesus is doing what anyone would expect from a Jewish religious leader. This was just the status quo for the Jewish religious leaders, to treat Gentiles with indifference at best. And sometimes, at worst, they would hurl verbal abuse at them. Jesus wasn't hurling verbal abuse, but he was ignoring her. In the Gospel of Mark, we read that wherever Jesus was going, he gets there. He enters a house, and he does this trying to keep as low a profile as possible. He doesn't want anyone to know he is there. And this woman follows him all the way to the house, and she's crying out. She's making a scene for sure. You put those pieces together, and I think you get to the point of what the disciples say to Jesus. They say, send her away, for she's crying out after us. But I think, especially when you look at how Jesus responds, what they're really saying is, give her what she wants, or she'll leave us alone. Just do this healing, and get her out of here. So, you know, it's good that the disciples know without question Jesus can do the healing. They have confidence in that. But in their mind, they want this request to be granted because they're annoyed, frustrated with her. They know that she risks exposing them on their mission of secrecy, whatever that is. So it's not about compassion for the disciples. It's about the inconvenience. It's a matter of pragmatism. And because for the disciples, this is a matter of pragmatism, it punctuates the fact that Jesus' apparent indifference is just a part of the Jewish custom, the Jewish tradition. And they expect it. And Jesus answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So he's saying that to the disciples, but loud enough so that the woman can hear it. It seems that that Jesus does understand the disciples are asking him to do this healing, to heal the Canaanite woman's daughter, and let's get her out of here. But Jesus effectively says, I didn't come for the Gentiles. I came for the Jews. Which means, I'm not going to heal her. At least that's what it sounds like. And that shouldn't surprise us. Remember back in chapter 10, Jesus sends the disciples out to preach, to teach, even to cast out demons. And he says, only go to the Jews. Remember this, Matthew 10, verses 5 and 6. The 12 Jesus sent out, instructing them, go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Same words he's used here. So Jesus is acting like any Jewish religious leader would, indifferent and avoidant to the Gentiles. He's being consistent with the very things that he has said. He didn't allow the disciples to go to the Gentiles, neither will he go to the Gentiles. But it's uncomfortable for us to hear these things because we know that this is not consistent. This is not consistent with the character of Jesus. This is not who he is. As I've said, he has dispensed healings so generously, has been moved to compassion so many times, and we have seen it already. We have seen him already do this for Gentiles. Remember the centurion with a servant that was ill, and Jesus healed him with a word, and the centurion and the servant were both Gentiles? Do you remember Jesus crossing the Sea of Galilee to the region of the Decapolis to find those two demoniacs and cast the demons out of them? Gentiles. So Jesus has already engaged Gentiles. And again, we have seen the depth of his compassion that it crosses racial divides. He hasn't seemed to have a problem with this before. So knowing the character of Jesus, knowing who he is, this is so important, knowing who Jesus is, instructs us that there's something more going on, something beneath the surface, that Jesus is up to something. And I think this woman knows that too. Because as we're going to very soon see, Jesus is bringing, he is bringing something to the surface that would not be seen otherwise. It's buried in the ground of this woman's soul. And Jesus is reaching in there, even if it's painful, and he's going to pull it out. And he's going to show all of us. Verse 25 says, but she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. She's actually throwing herself at the feet of Jesus, hurling herself down. Again, she calls him Lord. Undoubtedly, she sees something in Jesus that's beyond seeing. She sees something beneath the words that are being said, beyond the words that are being said. And she says, help me. And now her plea is stripped down. You can hear it. It's more urgent. It's more desperate. Where else in all the earth can this woman go? Help me. You know when you're desperate, words begin to fail. And where else can any of us go but to the feet of Jesus? So even if convention, culture, the responses that she's been getting, even if all of these things are against her, still she presses in. She persists. She knows this place at the feet of the Son of David is exactly where I need to be. And he answered, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. That's got to be one of the hardest things that Jesus says, especially when you dig into what he's really saying. But before we do that, we see words on a page in black and white, and none of that could possibly convey the tone of Jesus' voice, expressions on his face. You know that something hard can be delivered in love, and it's disarmed, like the bitterness is taken out of it. We can only speculate how Jesus may have said it, but I don't think he said it like a self-righteous Pharisee. But however icy or warm that delivery, Jesus is very intentionally pressing on an exposed nerve. He calls the Jews children. And children have the right, they have the priority, they have the privilege, they have the love. It's their right to receive first. They should. They're the children. They should be fed before the dogs. And he calls the Gentiles dogs. Dogs were unclean animals. You know, the Jews had adopted a racial slur for Gentiles. Dogs. Jesus is using a racial slur. He doesn't use it directly, but the implication is there. Remember what Jesus said about dogs earlier? In the Sermon on the Mount, actually, he said, do not give to dogs what is holy. So you can see that whether the delivery was warm or cold, Jesus very clearly is pressing a racial nerve. And it dramatically increases the tension of this encounter, and I think you can feel that. And she said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. This is an amazing response to what Jesus has just said. Notice there's no presumption in her words. She doesn't claim any right. In fact, she's admitting to her unworthiness. I don't belong at the table. I don't have a right. I don't deserve anything. But you are the Messiah. That's the implication. She knows it. And so her claim is essentially this, because she knows him. Though it is not right for me to eat with the children, it's still right that I eat. And in that moment, and I don't know if she realizes this or not, but what she is doing is bringing to the forefront God's plan for Israel's Messiah. Isaiah 49:6 says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant, this is talking about the Messiah, to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you a light for the nations, that my salvation shall reach to the ends of the earth. Yes, it is right that she should be fed by Israel's Messiah, because that is what he came to do. For not only has he come to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, he has also come to be a light unto the nations, a signal for the nations. And this Canaanite woman, this unclean woman, sees in him the signal for the nations, the light of the world. And she says, feed me, heal my daughter. She knows that this indifference that she's seeing on the surface, this is not characteristic of Israel's Messiah. There is more, and she will have it. And this whole story has been building to the very next climactic statement. And I can't help but hear an overwhelming flood of compassion in Jesus' voice, like a breaking of all of that indifference and just full-on warmth and favor in the words, oh woman, great is your faith, be it done as you desire. I mean, I see Jesus, I see tears in his eyes as he happily gives to her what she has come for. There are so many episodes where the Jewish religious leaders tried to defeat Jesus in an argument. We looked at some of those this morning in the class here. And they fail. They cannot defeat Jesus in an argument. But this woman does it. Though I think Jesus is wanting it to happen the whole time. This is the only person in the Gospel of Matthew that Jesus ascribes great faith to. Great faith. He's told the disciples a bunch of times that they have little faith. But this woman has great faith. And I think that the whole time, through that indifferent facade, through the hard things that have been said, what Jesus is doing is reaching into this woman's soul and pulling out the greatness of her faith. Look at it. How can these things be seen without resistance? The Canaanite woman, she followed Jesus. She threw herself at his feet in desperation. She knew his identity. She understood his heart and his purpose. She pressed in, even in the face of resistance. And as of yet, nobody in the Gospel of Matthew has done all of that. It is her. How remarkable that it comes from an unclean Gentile woman. And just as this woman believed Jesus could, he did. And immediately, her little girl is healed and restored to her, freed from bondage. And I can't imagine the worship that erupts from her in that moment, but we aren't told about it. So again, Jesus' hard response to her, his hard words, they're not to be cruel or to be harsh, but they're to draw out the faith. Maybe if you have felt, as you have come to God desperately asking for things and get no response, and it seems cruel and it seems harsh, maybe Jesus is doing something else. Maybe he's drawing out of you a greatness of faith. There's nowhere else that you need to be except at the feet of Jesus. Do not leave there. Do not leave there. And you know what's amazing? That Jesus takes this faith of this woman, and she exposes it. And the disciples see it. Do you know who else sees it? Every single reader of the Gospel of Matthew, literally billions of people, have seen the greatness of this woman's faith. And so what an incredible gift he gives her, not just to cast out the demon from her daughter, an amazing gift, but to show Christendom forever what greatness of faith looks like in this Canaanite woman, this dog. It's amazing. And it is a foreshadowing. It is a foreshadowing of the things to come. When God the Father will raise his one and only son on that cross as a signal for the nations. And so when we look at that signal, at him who was pierced for our transgressions, then we are pierced. We are pierced by the wounds he received. And when we go to that tomb and we find it empty and we find not death there, but life, then in that moment, every racial divide is dissolved. They do not matter one bit. What matters is Christ, is his blood, is his bloodline of faith. And so we come to him. We come to him whose blood was shed on our behalf, who makes the unclean clean, that we might be his and found in him. And all of that from something that just seems so difficult on the surface, so good to work through Scripture. Let's go into the next section, and we're going to see this theme continue. In verse 29, we read, Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the cripple, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wonder when they saw the mute speaking and the cripple healthy and the lame walking and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. In the Gospel of Mark, we learn that Jesus has traveled to the region of the Decapolis along the shore of Galilee. Another Gentile region. He's with the Gentiles. In fact, in these travels, when he left Capernaum, he left Gentile lands for this entire journey. I'm sorry, he left Jewish lands for the entire journey and was only in Gentile lands. And it's described in just a couple paragraphs here, but this journey took at least a couple of weeks, even perhaps a few months. It was a long journey. Now, we don't see him going to Caesarea Philippi in our passage, but that's because Matthew isn't arranged chronologically. We'll see in the next chapter, Jesus in Caesarea Philippi. And it makes a lot of sense if that happens between when Jesus was in Tyre and Sidon and when he's in the Decapolis, like this map shows. Although we can argue about that if we like, and later, probably. So Jesus went secretly to Tyre and Sidon, and now that he's come down back towards the Sea of Galilee, but on the Decapolis side, we know that all attempts at keeping a low profile are now gone because there are crowds of people following him, and he's no longer holding back. Again, he seems to be healing everybody that's coming to him. All the works of the Messiah that we have seen so far in Matthew are now being done for the Gentiles, exclusively for the Gentiles, and openly, unrestrictedly for the Gentiles. And at the end of verse 31, there's this incredible statement. You saw it, and they glorified the God of Israel, which is not something Matthew would note about the Jews. If they glorify somebody, it already is assumed that it's the God of Israel. But for the Gentiles, for the pagans, they are seeing in Jesus that the God of Israel is true, and they glorify him. It's amazing. Like the signal of the nations is being raised in Jesus Christ. And he healed everything. Isaiah 11:10, again, in that day, the root of Jesse, who shall stand as a signal of the peoples, of him shall the nations inquire. And we're just getting the first tastes of it here in this passage. The power and provision God gave to the Jews, Jesus now lavishes upon the Gentiles that come to him. Then Jesus called the disciples to him and said, in verse 32, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I'm unwilling to send them away hungry lest they faint on the way. And the disciples said to him, where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd? And Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7 and a few small fish. And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the 7 loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowd. And they all ate and were satisfied. And And they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got on the boat and went into the region of Magadan. Well, you know that this account is very similar to the feeding of the 5,000. It's so similar that a lot of scholars say it's just the same thing that happened, and it's, you know, slightly modified and told twice. So there's only one miraculous big feeding. That's what some scholars are saying, but it ain't right. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but there are some significant differences, and I'll point them out, and we're going to use these differences to step through the passage. So first, and very obviously, there's the different size. Smaller crowd now. It's 4,000 instead of 5,000. And of course, this is the counting of the men, women and children aside. So if you were to add in women and children and just conservatively say double the number, we're dealing with a crowd of 8,000 Gentiles here. A huge number. Another difference is the duration. The last time, the Jewish crowds, they chased Jesus down. They saw him on the boat going down the Sea of Galilee, and they ran along the countryside, and they cut him off at the pass so they could get more stuff from him. But this time is different. They've been following Jesus. They've been with him now for 3 days. They've exhausted their food supply. They're hungry. Likely their stomachs are gnawing at them, and still they are not leaving. They stay despite the fact that they're out of food. And Jesus sees that. He sees their desire and their commitment and their need. And he's deeply moved to compassion, it says. He overflows with compassion. This is the default state of Jesus' heart. Compassion. When I am triggered, it is not compassion. When Jesus is triggered, it is compassion. It's compassion. And he is deeply moved. He overflows and he gives to these people their daily bread. And that helps us to see that the indifference of the last passage was just a ploy to get to the heart of that woman. It wasn't actual indifference. And notice also, speaking of that last passage, how bread links the two together, the feeding of the 4,000 and the Canaanite woman. Because what we have here is not breadcrumbs falling from the table. We have a full-on feast, a meal that fills and it satisfies. And we see that through the Canaanite woman and through this Gentile crowd of some 8,000 people, that the Gentiles have a full share in the Messianic banquet. The doors of heaven have been flung wide open. And this banquet is so abounding that not only does it satisfy, but there is more than enough. There are leftovers. And this is another difference. The leftovers. The feeding of the 5,000, there were 12 baskets left over. In this feeding, there are 7 baskets left over. Now, it is using a word for basket, a different word for baskets. It's actually the same word for basket as when they lowered Paul in a basket down the city wall. So presumably, this is a large basket that a person could fit in. 7 of them. But it is interesting that you had 12 baskets of leftovers, and now you have 7. And if you've been around a while, you know what these numbers represent in the Bible. 12 represents the people of God. 7 represents completeness or fullness. As if when you put these two stories together and you get these left over, the 12 and the 7, that maybe what we're seeing here is a picture of the full, complete amount of the people of God. The fullness of the people of God. Jews and Gentiles together. And it's conjecture, but I think there's something in that. And then another difference, there's this dismissal. So in the feeding of the 5,000, there was this spontaneous, chaotic rush to coronate Jesus as king. Here, there's no rush. It's unhurried. Jesus doesn't usher the disciples out of there quickly, but they leave together. And it's peaceful. They go to the other side of the Sea of Galilee together on this boat without a storm, and they go back to Jewish lands. Matthew tells us that Jesus and the disciples land in Magadan, which no one knows where that is, not exactly. There's some guesses, and one of those guesses is that maybe Magadan or Magadan is just another way or a variant of the name Magdala, which would be the hometown of Mary Magdalene. There's no way to know, but I like to think that when they went to the other side, another disciple was made. But wherever it was, wherever Magadan is, it's Jewish territory, and so this mission to the Gentiles concludes. And very soon, the mission to Galilee will conclude. And through this little mission to the Gentiles, well, it could have been months, Jesus upends again what it means to be clean and unclean. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person. It's what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. It's not your bloodline or your race that makes a person clean. It's faith in Jesus Christ that makes a person clean. And so racism is unclean. Racism is disgusting. It is abhorrent. For on that cross, Jesus gave his life as a signal for the nations, from every people to be gathered to him, every tribe, tongue, and language. And so, disciples of great faith, we give our lives as he gave his life to bring in that diverse number. And I'm going to press on a nerve. Perhaps you've heard of DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, or inclusivity. Now, for some, that's a joke, DEI. For some, it's like a religious doctrine. Diversity. Jesus is so determined that his people will be diverse that he dies on a cross so he could be raised as a signal for the nations. Equity, from lowest to highest, poorest to richest, by faith all are given the right to become sons and daughters of the Most High God. Inclusion, regardless of any possible exterior factor, Jesus includes all those who believe in him in his messianic banquet. Which means that the only place in all existence where DEI will actually work is in the kingdom of God. It is the only place where it can be truly implemented for the good of all people. And our society gets it wrong. Our society gets it wrong both in its rejection of DEI and in its implementation of DEI. There's only one place, one man, one God-man, who gets it right. And the most critical factor in meaningful DEI is faith in Jesus Christ. And Matthew presents this unclean Gentile woman as three strikes in the Jewish world. Matthew presents her as an example of faith for all of Jesus' followers for all of time. She throws herself at the feet of Jesus in desperation. She unashamedly proclaimed who he is, knew his identity and proclaimed who he was. There was no shame in that. I mean, she was unashamedly doing it. She understood his heart. She understood his purpose. She believed in it beyond her circumstances. She pressed in even in the face of resistance. And Jesus said to no one else in this gospel, this woman has great faith. This woman has great faith. What kind of faith do you have? This is what great faith looks like. Remember, I said this some time ago. The disciples had little faith. Theirs grew. It became pretty great. But it doesn't matter, little faith or great faith. Any amount of faith opens the doors of heaven. Any amount of faith opens the doors of heaven. And yet, we cry out with that one man who had a demon-possessed son, "I believe, help my unbelief. My faith is small. Give me great faith." And we see in this woman what that looks like. Father, increase our faith. We want to be people of great faith, not floundering in little faith, but confidently following you, obeying you, proclaiming who you are, resting at your feet, pressing in even when circumstances are against us, believing. Father, help us. It is so easy to stand up here and preach about, and so hard to go out and live it. So easy to sit in a seat and hear it. So hard to go out and do it. So, Father, increase our faith. Help us to grow spiritually. You have called us sons and daughters, and we want to now live as your sons and daughters. I pray these things because of Jesus, because of his blood, because by faith he has brought us into that awesome bloodline. In Jesus' name, amen.